Right, guys, let's get going, eh? Because we've got the last session of the day. Yay! And normally the session's the best session to do because TechFest follows. And everyone wants to get out the door, so they want me to speak really quickly. But unfortunately, it's not that way today because we've already had our TechFest, or our Tech Live, as it might be. Okay, what a weird room. It's an odd layout. You know, you guys can come in closer. Yeah, people in the IT industry don't bite, eh? Well, not very hard, at least. Okay, so let's start off with a little bit of an intro. My name's Rob Hawthorne. I work for a company called Theta Systems Limited, otherwise known as Theta. Ta-da-da! And I am the head of Microsoft Solutions and Architecture. What a fancy title that is, eh? Who else has got a fancy title like me? Anyone? All right. Clive has. He's got a really fancy title. Look, I've been working with data and data warehouses and all the SQL Server products since 6.5, since 1998. So SQL Server is my passion. I love the product. I think it's probably the best product that Microsoft has released. It covers a breadth of capability. You can do so much with it, from just storing data through to analyzing data through to producing data and pretty reports and graphs and charts and all sorts of things. Transforming, the scalability of SQL Server is just incredible for where it is. The bang for your buck that you get is amazing. And because I love it so much, I actually wrote a book called Microsoft SQL Server Database Development from Scratch. It was for SQL Server 2000. Do you know I still sell copies of that book today? I get a royalty check every 3 months for about $7.50. So I was planning on retiring fairly soon, but maybe not. Unfortunately, those royalty checks cost me $25 to bank, so they sort of end up in a pile in my drawer. I also lectured at Vic Uni. I took Info Systems 222. Yeah, I can't quite see that screen there. I might just turn that a little bit. And that came about just through going up and doing some guest lecturing up at the uni and helping them to actually understand SQL Server and the platform and all sorts of things. So they invited me to go and do that. And there's probably some people in the room that may have actually attended that course. If so, lucky you, because you basically were given your grades. You didn't really have to work very hard for them. I'm also New Zealand's time trialist wife-carrying champion. That is my wife strung over my shoulders there. And she has always regretted me showing that photo because it's not probably the most flattering one of her. And just recently, I've become half the man that I used to be because I won my very first corporate boxing match in May this year. So I went on the journey. It's IT heavy hitters. So if any of you IT people feel like you want to go and punch somebody in the face and get away with it, sign up to IT heavy hitters. When I started that out in November of last year, I weighed 93.8 kilos. By my fight night, I was 77.3. So I dropped 15 kg. You work hard, you have a great time. It's awesome. It hurts. Don't get me wrong, it hurts. I'm back up to 82 now. Unfortunately, my friend Bear doesn't leave me alone. Bear has a great following. It's not all fun and games, though. Unfortunately, we lost one of our own this week. Andrew was on his way over to come and speak here at TechEd and passed away on the flight going into Sydney. So he's going to be sorely missed. You know, he's an absolute expert in this field. So, you know, it's just something for us to be aware of and make sure that we are understanding towards his family and giving them our best wishes. So I just thought it was nice to give him a little bit of a remembrance piece there. All right. So what are we discussing? Effectively our agenda. We're going to look at OLAP versus Tabular. Are you guys playing with Tabular yet? Anyone? Okay, I've got a couple. All right. 2012 or 2014, doesn't really matter. It's pretty much the same. Who's using PowerPivot? Okay, if you're using PowerPivot, you can use Tabular. It's effectively the same thing. But we're going to cover off some of the key differences, just the high-level ones, and we're going to look at the four key areas that you need to be aware of when you're building Tabular models. And then all going well, we'll have a little bit of Q&A, or you guys can all just go, hey, thanks very much, Rob, at 5:15 and run out the door, you know, whichever what you want to do. Oh, sorry, I should explain these. So I like to give swag away at my presentations because IT people love swag, right? So we have two of these. Unfortunately, they're called iHelis. Oh, don't know why. Helicopters, if you can see them, sitting here. So, and we have some water bottles. Now, Clive and I did a presentation 2 years ago, something like that. My wife made these beautiful chocolates, handmade chocolates. And as part of our presentation, we were giving out chocolates. Clive threw us one of those chocolates, and some lady had her head down typing, and it went boom right in her head. So we're not very good at throwing, okay? So if you get hit in the head by a water bottle, I'm sorry about it. I did say to her she should have been paying attention and then she wouldn't have been hit in the head with chocolates, but that didn't go down very well. Okay, so Tabular versus OLAP. The big difference is there's one catalogue has one model. In OLAP, you can have one catalogue with multiple cubes inside it. So this actually changes the way that you think about what you're doing, okay? So it means that you are writing effectively databases and storage mechanisms for an encompassing query. It's in-memory technology. Then that means that the data is only available to you while the memory, while the service is running. As soon as the service stops, well, I guess it's the same with traditional OLAP. If you stop the service, you're not going to get an answer, are you? I don't know, maybe the little gremlins might come out and give you an answer, but pretty much not. But the data is only persisted in memory. It's written to disk, but it's loaded into memory. The biggest difference is OLAP will load some components into memory, whereas Tabular will load all components into memory. So there are things that OLAP have that it just won't put into memory. It's columnar, who can say it? Get a water bottle if you can say it. Hey, there we go. So, that word changes the way that the data is stored. And we'll have a quick look at that in just a sec. And it's also highly compressed. And because the data is highly compressed, and we'll look at how it does its actual compression as we go through, then it means that it takes up less physical space. So, both of them are actually scriptable via XMLA. Oh man, I'm going to have to slow down. I just had a coffee before, so I'm got my little coffee hit coming in. So they both use XMLA, which does mean that a lot of the scripts, etc., that you have, things like clear cache and process and those sorts of things will work. Columnar data store principles. Hey, I actually said it. Far out. So if I've got a little, yeah, I have. I've got a little pointer on this. So on the left here, we've got our row, and on our right, we've got our columnar based. And what happens with row is that we select US product A 500, and that gets stored as one item on disk, okay? And then, therefore, our next one gets stored as US product B 1800. What's different with columnar-based is we store a distinct list of unique values for a column, and it's a distinct list of unique values. That's the thing that's the big difference, right? We haven't got any... So this is actually slightly incorrect the way that it's showing, because it's showing two USs there. That would actually only be one US stored there. So why would you use Tabular? In what scenarios are you going to use Tabular? Yeah, fast development is right there, right? Yeah, see, that's easy. Come on, guys, this isn't hard. I know it's a 300-level session, it's the end of the day, but... Okay, the development environment is very fast. It's very quick to build a model compared to what it is in traditional OLAP, though I've built so many OLAP ones, it's kind of the same for me now, I think. But it all resides in memory, so that means that you should be getting what? Much better performance. You can build models directly from the source. You do not need to go and build a data warehouse. So you can put a model directly over an Excel spreadsheet if you wanted to. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. You get integration with the Hadoop ODBC driver, so meaning that you can now go and index Hadoop stores online and then go and do search repositories over the top with your analysis. and it supports direct query mode. Who knows what direct query mode is? Go. Yeah, effectively, that's a good way to describe it. But do you want to say it a bit louder to make sure that everyone's aware? Okay, here we go. Here's the first throw. Wasn't bad. Just warming that arm up. So let's look. So that's just a brief overview of what Tabular is and why you'd use it. So let's look at some of the design principles you should be taking away. Simple things first. As I said, you do not need to use a star schema, but a star schema is still best. Who knows what a star schema is? Hey, great. What's a star schema, mate? Beautiful. Oh, no. See, I've learned. I gave the big bling away at the beginning of the session last time and people walked out, see? So I'm not doing that to the end. The other thing that you should do is you should use views. Why do we use views? Huh? No look. Perfect. What else can we use views to do? Yes, go. Just call it out. You don't need to put your hand up. Beautiful. Great reason. What else? Oh, did you guys hear what he said? Yeah? Okay. Not a bad one. That's pretty good too. There's one more that I'm thinking of. Security kind of? Yeah, you could make it. Yeah, true. Aggregation. You could do aggregation in your views instead. Yeah, that's true. You could do group by. So you don't really need to because you're aggregating it inside a model, but you could. What I'm thinking of is who's got date dimensions in their data warehouses? How far back do your date dimensions go and how far forwards do they go? Way further than the data that you've actually got in your data warehouse. So if you do an inner join inside a view, you limit that dimension down to what's facts that are actually relevant to it. It means your end users don't have to scroll through 2 million rows of data that's totally irrelevant. They have 200,000 rows of data presented to them that they can get to. That's as long as you've got a good star schema though, right? We're going to look at building a model. There's some things that pop up in tabular mode that you don't see in analysis services when you're building your model. And we're going to look at connections because connections always seem to be a problem. And columns. Why I've got choose wisely there. You'll see it when we actually go through the processing model and how it actually stores the data. But traditionally, when people build cubes, they build these really wide cubes. What's the problem with doing that with tabular? It's in memory, right? So you're going to chew up all your memory space. Okay, so you want to keep it targeted for exactly what you want it to do. A valuable lesson, and that includes the data that you're loading into it as well. Only load the detail that you need to solve the questions that are being asked of that model. Okay, so don't load millions of rows of fine-grained transactional detail if you just need account balances. Right. Here we go. Did I pray well enough to the demo gods? Dun, dun, dun. Okay, well, that's a good sign. We've got a screen. And, hey, we've got a remote connection into the environment. So all's working well so far. So, one of the things that I want to show you is when you first create a model, I need that one for later. Right, cool. When you first create a model, you can see here that we've got a couple of tabular models sitting inside my analysis services instance. If I go and connect to just a blank project that I created before, which is this one here, and I'll just take a little sec to open up. You can see there's no tables or anything in it. And we now refresh this. Hey, what's that? It instantly creates a workspace on the analysis services instance that you're working on. It's to actually be able to service your requests when you're actually playing with the data, but it is quite different from OLAP, whereas before you actually had to deploy a model before you could actually do anything with it. Now you're actually getting instant access to it. Let's have a look at connections. Okay, so we've got this nice little model here, and we're going to go off and we're going to add ourselves a table. And we're going to go to SQL Server, and we're going to use good old dot notation. Yeah, always ignore that warning. If you set your security up right, you don't need to worry about using user accounts. Okay, we've got some views here and some draws, results, etc. So we'll take this. We'll take this one called date. You just take a little sec to bring that in. And there we go with our date table. Oh, wait, hang on. I forgot to bring in another table. Oh, okay, tell you what I'll do. I'll just go and import it in again. And this time we'll bring in our results table. Lovely. So now we've got, Now we've got date and results. We can look at them in model view instead. But if I go and have a look at this table, what am I going to see? Who knows? Exactly. We're going to have two different connections on it. If we go and have a look at the properties of the table, where I can find it. Table properties, there it is. You see here we've got a connection name called SQL Server Lotto, localhost Lotto results. And we look at this table, and it says two. Oh, I'll tell you what, why don't we just swap it? Oh, wait, I can't. Okay, it's just one of the challenges that you have when you're building models. So be very careful when you're setting up and bringing tables in, because once you've done that, the only thing you can do is either delete the table and re-add it using an existing connection, or go and hack the XMLA underneath the hood. So you can get to the XMLA and go and hack it. You right-click and go view code. Oh, it wants to save it first, sorry. And you go and look for connection. It's actually hard to type on these little keyboards when you're standing up. And you can see here that I've got a connection here and I've got a connection here. But what it does is it uses this internal ID. So now you have to go off and find where that internal ID is used and then go and modify the tables. I'm pretty sure Microsoft will say that's not supported, okay? So instead, when you're adding tables, make sure you use the funny little button on the side here that says existing connections. Why is it bad to have multiple connections inside the model? Done. Yeah, exactly. Because every connection that goes through to the database takes up memory and it takes up resources when it's making connections through. Okay, so you don't want to have those going on. Righty-o. We actually don't need this one anymore. Oh, right, so that's the other thing. When we close that, and we now refresh, it's gone. So it's only a temporary working space. But it does mean that you need an analysis services instance that you can connect to build a model, which is quite different from traditional OLAP. OLAP, you actually don't need an analysis services one to connect to until you deploy. But in this case, you actually need one to connect to just to build the models. Righty-ho. What am I? Number 8. Is that correct? This one. Hardware. Okay. This is quite fundamentally different from previously with traditional OLAP. Your CPU is absolutely critical now. Your CPU and memory are what will make your tabular model fly for both query performance and processing performance. You have to be very aware what part of the engine is being used at what time, whether you're using the storage engine or the formula engine, because if you're using the storage engine, it's multi-threaded and you're going to get a bang for your buck out of all those cores and CPUs that you're sticking in those great big boxes or your virtualized CPUs. But if it's coming out of the formula engine, it's all single-threaded. So you'll end up with wait times while things are being resolved. Your disk isn't so important anymore. Because everything's loaded in memory, disk doesn't really matter so much, right? We as in Theta are doing a project for one of our customers in the South Island, and we're building a nice big scale-out tabular model architecture for them. And this is the cool thing about it, is that it very much like traditional OLAP. You can build these nice scale-out models because they're effectively read-only sources. And what we've got is we've got a web server with the tabular model on it, and we've got another web server with a tabular model on it. And whilst the users are querying it and doing the bits and pieces they need to do, that's all good. And we actually do the processing off on a third server. And when the time comes, we turn the web server off on one server. We restore and back up, we back up and restore the cube onto that web server. And then we back up and then we switch it back on again, shut the other one off, and back up and restore the cube on the other server. So it means that they have virtually zero downtime in their application. We have that capability because it's a web-based app. You guys can't see that, can you? I must have clicked through something. Or I hit back. That must have been what it was. Some other things to watch out for is your operating system. Make sure you turn off things like power saving mode on your servers. It's on by default. Even in Windows Server 2012, you go and have a look. And so your server's not busy enough all the time, so it actually puts it into a nice power saving mode, and then you come along to do a query and it goes, hang on, now I can answer your question. Okay, so there's some things in there that you just need to watch out for. There's a really, really great white paper I can give you guys a link to. I didn't actually put it in the slide deck, which is a bit silly. There's two of them. One of them is hardware sizing and scalability for Tabular, and the other one is performance troubleshooting for Tabular. You have all of these different Tabular settings to go and play with. Make sure you turn off the log flight recorder enabled option. That's actually on by default in both versions of analysis services, or both modes of analysis services. And do you guys know what it does? It's sitting there logging the requests that the users are doing. It's effectively a profile trace sitting in the background. Okay? And you'll get a little trace file inside wherever your default data directory is, and you'll end up hurting your performance. You only need it for debugging purposes, so turn it off in production environments. It's fine in dev, when you want to see what's going on, and maybe in test, but turn it off in your prod environments. We've got all these other options around memory allocation, so things like the hard memory limit. So at what point is analysis service going to start killing connections and aggressively reclaiming the cache back again? Because that's what your hard memory limit will do, okay? Your total memory limit is how much memory you're actually allowed to use in total. So one of the things is that one of Microsoft's recommendations is that you shouldn't host traditional OLAP and Tabular on the same server. Now, that does have implications for licensing and bits and pieces like that, but it's something to consider. Be careful when you're doing your memory calculations because they're in bytes, which is really helpful. You know, it would have been nice had they done it in megabytes like they do in SQL Server, but for some reason they do it in bytes, so you've got to be very careful with your calculation. And once you've actually calculated it out, take those commas out, because that really won't work. It'll accept them, and then you restart the service, and it'll just carry on using it. Okay, processing. This is probably the biggest thing that you need to be aware of. When you start processing, the first thing it does is it opens connections to the databases, or database, or data store, or whatever it is that you've got. And this is actually limited by a server setting called external connection timeout. Now, you can overwrite this in the connection string. You can specify the timeout. By default, it's about 60 seconds or something, I think it is. But if you've got a very slowly performing SQL server and it's not serving the requests in time, you might find your processing starts to fail. The data is then streamed to analysis services. So when the SQL query is executed, all the rows are transferred, streamed into memory on your analysis in your tabular instance, tabular mode. So what is this going to do to your memory? Use it up. It's going to take a big chunk of your memory. And this is actually something we faced when we were working with our customer, is that they had JD Edwards financial system. And we thought, good, we'll go right down to transactional level detail for them and be able to give them everything they need, because they drill right down to transactional level detail through this web app. We quickly found that that wasn't going to work. Millions of rows of data killed the server, just couldn't even process the cube in time. So what we ended up doing was changing it, using account balances for everything they needed up until the point where they went to the transactional level, and then we jump out to a SQL table to serve the results for that. So a little ugly, but there's not much you can do about it at the moment. Now, you also have to be aware that once it starts streaming the data in, it will then start compressing the data because it wants to actually not use as much memory space. But that could end up flooding your analysis services instance because if the CPUs aren't fast enough, it's not going to be able to do the compression fast enough and it's got more data coming in. The other thing to be aware of is if this is over your network, what's that going to do to your network? Okay? It's all right while it's on one little machine or it's a small subset of data, but if it's across your network and it's a large volume data set, that could be a problem for you. Okay, so then the fun begins. And this is quite cool. This is one of the great things about how it actually does its compression, right? Is that it actually converts all the data into integers using this data ID. That's what they actually call it internally. And it does it for all column types. And it uses either value or hash encoding. So anyone know what the difference might be between the two? This one could warrant a helicopter. I want to... Boom, boom. Hash uses more storage. That's right. But you get a helicopter, dude. Yes. You want me to throw it? Oh, I'll fly it over to you. Here we go. We've got some batteries. That might not be a really good idea. I'll put this one down here so I know that I've already given it away because otherwise I might do it twice and then I could be in trouble. Right. So value encoding stores the value exactly as it is. If it's an integer data type or, when I build data warehouses, I use a surrogate key all the time and I use integers for that. So it'll store that exactly as it is. If it's hash encoding, it's because it's a string or a text field and it needs to hash that value and therefore it then creates a pointer to it using an ID. The compression works segment by segment. So a segment is defined as having enough data. Microsoft aren't particularly specific about what enough data is. Okay, so it could be 8 million rows, don't know. It could be, it'll be variable because it'll be based on the actual data that you're streaming through to it and how big that's going to consume, right? The number of distinct values will affect the size of your segment. Makes logical sense, right? It's a columnar data store. So if you have lots and lots and lots of distinct values, your segment size is going to fill up very quickly and therefore your compression is going to happen. But it finishes reading and encoding the data and then it starts to apply compression, as we can see just at the bottom there. Oh, this is terrible. It dies when it goes on the screen. Just here, whilst it's actually starting to read in the second segment. So you're getting a constant stream of reading, encoding, compression. So your server usage resources while you're processing go like this. You can just see them climbing. Yeah?
You could use resource government.
You went to Tara's session, didn't you? Who else went to Tara's session? Wow! You guys love SQL. All right. I've got the right audience. It was a good session, actually. Right, so you can check your encoding type as well. So there's a DMV query that will tell you whether you're using hash encoding or value encoding for a column. I think these slides are available. I only just uploaded them today, so I don't know what they do with them. I'm assuming they'll make them available for you somewhere. And that will actually allow you to begin to see the way that your data set's working. Now, I just got to check to see. Oh, yep. So what happens, how does the encoding work? Well, when it's going through and it's bringing the data set in, it parses the first few rows and goes, based on this, I reckon you are a integer or you are a string. What happens sometimes is we get into this ugly situation of re-encoding. And re-encoding means that SQL Server goes, oh, great, first few rows are integers. Fantastic. I'm going to define you as an integer and use value encoding for you. And then, unfortunately, it comes across this really ugly row. It's 99,999,999 with commas in it. And so then SQL Server goes, oh, right, it wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be, and then it has to re-encode the entire column as a hash encoding. So you have to watch out for this. There is a profile trace. Have you guys heard what's happening with Profiler? I'm not so happy about it. I like Profiler. I think it's a great tool, but oh well, we have to move on. So there is a profile trace that will actually tell you if this is occurring. Okay, so it's one of the things to do is that when you're actually building your models and watching what's going on, if you see this occurring, then you've either got bad data, 9 times out of 10, that's what it is, and how do we fix bad data? Go back to the source, that's right. Or we get rid of it out of our views. Another reason for views. You asked me 10 years ago if I would have used views anywhere, and I said, nah, no way. Stored procs all the day. But now views are, they're so flexible for building data warehouses and data models. The other thing that you can do is you can force it to choose the right type of encoding by switching around the way the data is stored, data is sorted when it's passed to the model. So if this is actually a true value and you don't want it to do re-encoding, you would put that value at the top. And you can use your view by doing select top 100% order by. I don't know why they never let you just do an order by. You have to do the top 100% thing. It's kind of odd. Does anyone know if Oracle supports doing direct order bys in a view? It does? Yeah. Maybe you should put that in for a feature request. So it's one way of getting around the re-encoding problem if it's actually valuable data or real data. Okay. Processing options. There's 7 of them. And the one that's by far the easiest is... Well, I can't hear you people. Come on, man. Processful. Yeah, there we go. Processful's the easiest. That was you at the back here. Okay, here we go. Yeah, Processful is by far the easiest. Because what it does is it... And it also means that the cube remains online. So what happens is that it takes a copy of the cube and the users are carrying on querying the cube, doing their bits and pieces, and in the background, it's streaming the data in, doing the encoding, doing the compression. Once the cube's built, it then swaps them out of memory, swaps them over. What do you think that does to your memory? Doubles it. Right. So whilst Processful is by far the easiest and normally the best, it's also some of the most challenging when you are dealing with some of the server sizes in New Zealand. We have this real problem in New Zealand about going big. We always want to do it on a string budget It's one of the things I love about working in the States is that you go out there and you work on a project and you go, oh, I need a new server. Okay, here you go. How much memory do you want in it? 128 gigs? Yeah, sweet. Yeah. Here in New Zealand, oh, I need a new server. Oh, yep, okay. How much memory do you want? 128 gig? Yeah, no, you get 16. So make sure that you're aware of what the different processing options do for you. They will have a real big impact on your model and the availability of your model and how quickly you can get it back to your end users. There's no sense in reading them all out. You guys can read that as well as I can, and very well documented as well. So when you're processing as well, you may want to use multiple transactions to reduce your memory usage. So if you set this option, and this is not available in the GUI, so if you right-click and go process cube, you won't see this option. Okay, you have to script it to get to it. You can set it to transaction equals false. And that will allow you to create multiple process commands inside batches that aren't grouped together. So it's great if you want to do several tables at once. How are we going for time? Oh, heaps of time. All right, so, number one. So I was just wanting to show you guys that DMV. Oh, did I delete it? That's going to be interesting, isn't it? Did I save it? Did I? Otherwise, I've got to type it. Ah, there we go. I did save it. Hey. So if we just run this against my model, you can see here that we have got on my date table some columns stored as hash encoding, which is U2, and we've got a lot of them which are stored as value encoding. So you begin to look at them and you're going, you can sort of see why they're actually being stored as value encoding, right? Because things like day of week, which is an integer, and actual date. We get down further. Get down further to some of our results. And even though our results are stored as integers in that fact table, Analysis Services has chosen to make that a hash encoding. One of the neat things it actually does is, and I'll probably miss this before when we do the encoding, is if you've got sequential values, like you've got 901, 902, 903, 904, it looks at it and it goes, aha, I can store this as 1, 2, 3, 4, and just subtract 900 from it. And then when I go to present it to you, I just add 900 to it. So it's quite clever in regards to things like that, right? So it makes it very aggressive in its compression model. So if we actually go and look at our table, our results table, can you guys guess what this might be about, this data set? Funny that, eh? How about that for a naming convention? So if we actually go and look at it and we look at the date surrogate key, we can see our date surrogate key is an integer. Oh, sorry, that's draw. Sorry, dates, that one. This is a little blurry. Or my eyes are old, one of the two. I was going to build a nice little demo on using data mining on the lotto results. Because I've got the lotto results here that actually go, well, you'll see in a minute, they go back quite a way. In fact, to all of time. And I thought, would a data mining algorithm solve my problem about my book not really making me rich and being able to retire? Right. Okay, querying. So we've covered off general design of a cube. We've covered off what you need to think about for your infrastructure and your hardware. We've covered off the processing options and how that actually works and utilizes the memory supported by that hardware. And now we're going to look at it from an end user's perspective, because there's nothing worse than having a manager screaming at you because you're not getting what they want. So the query processing architecture can use both MDX and DAX in tabular mode. So if you are proficient at MDX, I don't think anyone really is proficient at MDX, but if you are, you can carry on using MDX. And there are some things, some tools, which will use MDX natively against a tabular model. And one of those might be... Sorry? Did you say Excel? Yeah. Yeah, so Excel. And another one, I'm out of water bottles. Oh, yeah, got it just enough on it. Reporting services. So, he's trying hard. We might have to have a race or something, eh? swap me a water bottle for a helicopter. So, what would natively use DAX? PowerView, yeah, exactly. So PowerView actually natively generates DAX queries. It's one of the only tools it currently does. So your DAX queries can reference DAX calculations, okay? Which is what's stored in your formula engine. Your MDX queries reference MDX and DAX calculations. But your DAX queries cannot reference MDX calculations. Does that make sense? Yeah, so if on your cube you create a scope item that's a calculation and then you write MDX, that will actually be able to reference that calculation. But if you write an MDX scope query and then try and use DAX over the top of it, it won't work. I think we've already covered the fact that your formula engine's single-threaded, But it allows you to do your very rich expressive calculations, and those are things like your sum x's and your averages and bits and pieces like that. Your storage engine has compressed data in memory. And if you do things like counts, that's where that comes from. But the entire column is scanned when it's reading something. So just be aware that you can end up with bottlenecks in the storage engine as well. So the four W's when you're looking at performance for queries is who? Is it everyone or just some people? Normally it's the senior managers screaming, so therefore they're the ones that get all the attention and you don't bother to go and ask anyone else. Right? It's just the way that it works. The squeakiest wheel gets all the oil, isn't it? Isn't that the standard statement? What? Is it all queries or one query? Because these things will actually help you to define where your problem might sit. When? Is it happening all the time? Sometimes? Is it a cold cache, warm cache? And where? Is it your formula engine or your storage engine? So, while we're on caching, because caching is probably the biggest piece for it, your server, when it starts, does not load your model into memory straight away. What loads your model into memory straight away? First query, that's right. The first user query pushes the model up into the cache. So what do you think that we're going to do for our customer when we're swapping loads? Warm it. How do we warm it? In a scheduled task. There we go. So as part of the end of our ETL process or our swap task, we'll call a query, force the model to be loaded up into memory. Your MDX queries can be cached as well, but your DAX queries using evaluate or select won't cache calculations. So it's just something to be aware of too, okay? The Vertipack caching was built to try and help with some of the challenges that you have with the caching. So it's a pretty simple caching layer, and it was designed so that the queries would respond a lot faster than what they would without the cache sitting in there in the middle. But it is pretty simple. So when you are actually scanning and seeing what's going on with Profiler, and that's hence the reason I asked Tara what they're going to do when Profiler is deprecated, because everything around analysis services is driven from Profiler. You get a little bit of stuff with the DMVs, but you just do not get enough insight, right? You'll actually begin to see where you're hitting the cache in the green and where you're not hitting the cache in the red. Right. Okay, so what number again? Number one. Okay. So I'm just going to empty my Profiler trace table, because there's no sense in showing you guys the old stuff that we had in there. And I've got a Profiler trace set up ready to go. It's going to dump to that Profiler trace table. I've selected some events here, just one or two, but one of the ones I need is this column called request ID, and some of the events that I need are query end, excuse me, and the Vertipack storage engine query end. This little bit of profile trace is going to help me to determine where my bottleneck might be occurring. Is it occurring in my storage engine or my formula engine? So I'm just going to run that. My little profile trace is going to sit there, and we're going to go back and see. Oh, there's my model. So these are my lotto numbers with my different draws. You see they all go all the way back to 1987. There's a number of balls in the draw. You see there's only seven in that particular draw, but as you go through time, you see the numbers go up. You know, the state is all publicly available, eh? Yeah. It's quite a bit of fun to play with. And if I just run that query a few times, we should see some trace events happening. There we go. And maybe we'll just take one of these off. We'll add another one on. What do you want? Total strike draws. Most of them are zero. That's why the numbers go up, the amount of numbers that are actually available inside the draw, because you have things like strike, and then you also find some interesting things where they have double strikes. So they've actually got two stroke balls on. It doesn't seem to be something they've done very often recently. It seemed to be something they did in the past. And we'll just run our query a couple more times, make sure we've got some data. And now we have this lovely SQL select statement here. Oops, not that one. Okay, so all it's really doing is just getting us a count of the query executions and then looking at the query duration and comparing that across the storage engine and formula engines. And if we just execute that, because I cheated and pre-wrote the query and didn't want to have to do it, we can see that our bottleneck is sitting inside our formula engine. So, or our longest running time is inside our formula engine. It's not a true bottleneck because the data set is so small. What would be causing that? We go back and we have a look at that MDX. Oh, sorry, that, go away. We go back and have a look at that. What would be forcing it to be having some issues in the formula engine? Yeah, the calculated measures. That's right. So things like the averages and the sums. The counts are okay, but the averages and the sums are not. Right. I think we're actually going to finish slightly early, guys. Is that all right? Anyone worried about that? No. Just means you get to go to the pub sooner, eh? No? Dinner? Anyone going to buy me dinner? Helicopter for dinner? Yay, I'm going to take it. And it's not Macca's either, though, eh? Actually, last night I went to, what was the place called, Joe? Botswana Butchery. It's very, very good, but, yeah, it hurt a little bit, eh? I know you had a charge in Auckland, that's for sure. Okay. Oops. So, actually, that's basically about the end of where we're at. So, just a little bit about us. Our company's growing. We're constantly looking for very good BI people and Microsoft people in general, actually. So if you want something from that, just get in contact with Nat and she'll help you. And there's some related content for you guys to go out and have a look at. If you want, feel free to email me or find me on Twitter or something like that, and I'll send you those links to the performance guides, because those performance guides are really, really good, especially if you've got some issues, because they take you through step by step about what you should be looking at. Basically, very similar to what we've done here. It's good old resources, and I think, oh, right, this is most important. If you guys want me to come back next year and give you more bling and more swag, you have to give me really good evals, okay? Yes. Say it with some commitment, guys, come on. Yeah! Oh, a little bit of hype. Okay. So we've got a good 10 minutes left, so want to fill the time in with some Q&A? Happy to do that, or you guys can disappear.
So I think one of the key things is to mark your date table as well.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
It's very important for your time-based tax calculation.
Sorry, I should have showed that inside the designer. Is that... what you should do is go in and find your date table and set it as your date table. This one's already been done because it was a pre-built model, because you do that in demos, right? There's a couple of times where, like Clive and I tried to build a BI solution, end-to-end BI solution in an hour, including ETL and reports and bits and pieces. We just got it done. And there was another time where I tried to implement full Kerberos in an hour. It actually worked. Just. Sorry, mate.
I've got a very, very quick, simple question. In 2010, you couldn't print the tabular model. Can you do that in 2013?
Well, that's a good point. I don't know. You mean just print out the designer from here? No. Still grayed out. But if you use the same model as what you would in analysis services, in SQL Server. Hello, what's it doing? I would have thought that it should have been there too. I would just use screen clipping and paste it.
That's what Microsoft
yeah, some things don't quite catch up as they should, you know. More questions? I've got to figure out what to do with this last helicopter, actually. Yes. 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 Okay, so you're really going for the helicopter, aren't you? No, you're right, you're right. That is why you can't cache. That is why they can't be cached, right? Go on, Bart, you had a question. I've got a... You've done very well, mate. Two.
Are you doing IT heavy hitters?
My wife has told me that I'm allowed to train, but I'm not allowed to participate. Even though I won, I'm like, I got... Yeah. Mate, I won. That's all that matters, right? Yeah. It wasn't pretty, don't get me wrong, okay? It was pretty close. Right. Yes?
What are the implications on the encoding of using GUIDs as surrogate keys?
They're not going to help you much at all. They're going to hash value those because they're treated more as a string than they are as an integer type. So in my viewpoint, I would never build a data warehouse using GUIDs. Or GUIDs, whatever you want to call them. The reason why is that they are very, very complex to maintain. And surrogate keys, just having an incrementing value is just so much easier to look after. Makes a bit more sense too. We had a real... Sorry? Yeah, just use a sequence number, yeah. We had a really interesting discussion inside Theater at one stage show. It was with your date table. Should you store that as an incrementing key for your surrogate key? Or should it be derived based on your date? So should it be stored as number one, or should it be stored as 2012-02-01? So, what's your viewpoints? Go.
Okay. Human readable is great,
yes.
But you won't get the compression if it's big, but there's not that many dates, so human readable.
True. Human readable? Because they're integers, it makes no difference in size, the value of how big the item is inside the column. Okay, for the helicopter, there is one question that you can see if you can answer for me. What is the biggest benefit for design for both OLAP cubes and tabular models using a human readable date key?
It's easier to just look at records and know what they are.
It's specific for the models. Specific for the models. Sorry? Kind of. You're on the right track.
Mm.
Okay, but there is one specific task that it actually solves a problem for.
Oh, differences.
No. Partitions. It makes partitioning really, really easy because you say it's from this range to this range and you don't have to join the fact table to the date dimension to pull out that date key or to do your partitioning. But I'm going to give him the helicopter anyway. He's worked so hard. Don't you guys reckon? Hey? Yeah! Now, you're not allowed to fly that inside. I don't know why. I think it would be a bit of fun. You should take it back to the office and see if you can land it on someone's desk. All right, guys. Any more questions? I'm going to be floating around. I'm probably going to go to the pub soon at any rate. So. Ah, yeah, that's good. So hyper-threading used to be a problem back in the day, but now SQL Server's hyper-threading enabled, but I'm not sure for analysis services, to be quite honest. I'd have to go and check. Yeah, most deployments these days are virtualized, so you're not really getting to see things like hyper-threading anymore. Has anyone deployed a physical server for SQL Server recently? No. You did it for... Oh, yeah. I hardly call a desktop under somebody's desk a server, maybe. That's our friends from Zed. So I don't really see that much of hyperthreading coming up anymore because everything's virtualized. You know, like that little machine that I'm using there, it's only got 4 gigs of RAM assigned to it, and it's performant enough for what I want to do for that little data set. There's only about 1,800 rows or something in the fact table.
The answer really is, though, that the hyperthreading is a lot better than the new hardware that's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you turn hyperthreading on, it's virtually another CPU without the problems that you used to have with hyperthreading. So it doesn't really matter.
I don't know what licensing implications it has either. That might be the other thing, because, you know, SQL Server's now licensed per core. A core, is it? Bugger. That's a shame. Because it's really only a virtual core, but okay.